Thank you, Mahvish, and thank you everyone who's joining us today online or in person. You didn't come here to hear me speak, so I'll keep this very brief. When the genocide began, many of us were profoundly distressed by the horrors visited upon Palestinians and the open, unabashed, if unsurprising, backing of this intensified genocidal colonialism by the global north. But we were also suffocated by the utter institutional silence and silencing back to back with the war in Ukraine, when institutions, companies, and all sorts of managerial and political leadership were elbowing each other out of the way to be the first to make public proclamations of also principled support. The contrast to the genocide in Palestine couldn't have been more illuminating. In fact, it was almost blinding. Many of us, but non-white students and staff in particular, felt deeply suffocated and alienated by the white silence of our departments and our institutions on this genocide, reminding us of Aimé Césaire's observation that Nazism was just colonialism internalized, that is, European colonialism applied to fellow Europeans, so that the outrage of white Christians over the Nazi genocide had less to do with the nature of the crime, which they were happy to inflict all over the world before, during, and after the Holocaust, and more with the nature of its victims, that it happened to fellow white people. I know of many students who had to take time out, who became ill and unable to function because of the live-streamed horrors in Palestine, and because the official response here was so suffocatingly clear that when push comes to shove, their lives are valued less than mine, that they must not speak too loudly, that they must not put brown lives over white feelings, that they must behave lest the law come down on them. We're well aware of the various histories of institutional complicity in colonial and imperial violence, both past and present. And we're also aware that the UK and its higher education landscape is a notoriously anti-Palestinian environment, and more broadly racist, sexist, and ableist, both politically and legally. So it's against this background that the initial idea for the series came to us in October, and it was twofold. One, to help create a space for those feeling affected by the genocide and the white silence around it. And two, to be an expression of the community of support we were creating, support for each other and support for our siblings in Palestine. So to create events to educate ourselves and to share our resources and our scholarship with wider publics who share our concerns and who share our sensitivities. The event today is an expression of the community we have built over the past 9 months, the community that stands up and fights back. It includes the Decolonized Anthropology Group and members of various departments at LSE and UCL, including Anthropology, Sociology, the Middle East Center, and beyond. It includes the courageous and brilliant students from Palestine Society and Islamic Society in the LSE Student Union, and all those students and staff at the encampment here at LSE. We have taken over the space visually, precisely because this movement is loud and bold and unapologetic in its demand for life, dignity, and equality. What does it mean to have academic events in times of genocide? What does it mean to teach and study in times of genocide? It's not the first genocide of our lifetimes, but it is the most transparent, the most live-streamed. The first event in this series was a reflection on the relationship anthropology has to Gaza. The second event was an invitation really to think about the British arms industry in relationship to Palestine and mobilizations against it. The third event was a talk on the history of and the future of politics in the Arab world with relationship to Palestine. And this event perhaps provides somewhat of an overarching summative narrative from colonization to decolonization. I would like to thank the people involved in this series and the volunteers today, our colleagues at UCL, in particular Amara Maqsood, Bramwell Spector, and Emily Glazer. The LSE Department of Anthropology and the Decolonized Anthropology Group, as well as the LSE Middle East Center, and in particular Yazan Doğan and Mayanka Mukherjee, Sara Ali, Atiye Tawassuli, and many others, our online moderators, Jack McGinn and Esilana McManaman, and our stewards, Merit Fumat, Salome, Dhikra Spitalier, and Ro Redfern. And special thanks to all the cleaners and staff whose invisibilized and underpaid labor is indispensable to the functioning of this university. And I would like to thank the LSE's senior management team for giving everyone clarity on who is who. Since 2021, students and staff have approached SMC with demands to divest LSE's money from Israeli apartheid, and management have done what they're supposed to do. They've been stalling ever since. Students have approached senior management again in January of this year with their own preliminary findings, and they've been met again with stalling. They told us our findings were wrong, largely because of their own lack of transparency. So students and staff spent months researching LSE's investments and produced a detailed 116-page report while management kept stalling. Hence the encampment, which is the key device to take the demand of our community and back it up with power. SMC has responded with more stalling tactics to distract and divert, with lies about the encampment, which it sends to the entire LSE. Our staff unions keep having to send correctives about these lies to the union members. It has responded with threats of expulsion from the building and potentially academic penalties. It has responded with increased security control and surveillance. In fact, management uses the same CCTV cameras made by Hikvision that Israel uses in the occupied West Bank, according to Amnesty International. Nevertheless, our negotiators have already won some significant concessions, £250,000 for scholars at risk from Palestine and £250,000 for student scholarships for Gaza. Incidentally, this is roughly the annual salary of the LSE's new director, including benefits, so there's that. And it, of course, pales in comparison with the amount of money the school invests directly and indirectly in the following fields. One, crimes against the Palestinian people. Two, investments in nuclear weapons. Three, fossil fuels. And four, it invests in the production and proliferation of arms. It's not far-fetched to argue that the LSE, like most if not all universities in the UK, not only financially support the ongoing genocide and the wider process of colonization of which it's a part, they in fact profit from it. These are investments of our fees and donations. They yield money. In other words, the school makes money off of the mass killing, off of the bombs and bullets, and off of the deliberate erasure of the higher education landscape of Gaza. Every single university in Gaza has been obliterated. Its students, teachers, and staff murdered in the hundreds and in the thousands. And our university has made money off of that. And this room and these microphones have been paid for with Palestinian blood. And so this is an academic event. And this is what it means to do academia in times of genocide. We can remain silent about it and silence others, or we can stand up and fight back with all means at our disposal. And that includes educating ourselves and our siblings. And that includes love and solidarity and dignity in our fight for collective liberation. The Palestinian movement today, yesterday, and tomorrow, the Palestinian struggle to be free like some of us and not others, is a struggle for equality. Palestine is one of the many zones where our collective humanity is being defended, and it's an honor to be able to share in that struggle. So to those on us, those among us who call on us to tone it down, as an activist and as an academic, I would say, with love, victory to the Palestinian people. Victory to the international solidarity movement against colonialism and imperialism, and therefore victory to the struggle for liberation and equality. And without further ado, please join me in welcoming again Ilan Pappé to our university.
Thank you. Should be on. Okay, great. Great to be here. Thank you for your invitation to this important series of lectures that you are conducting. It's a great pleasure to be in yet another university where the students are not just talking but also acting on behalf of the Palestinians and their rights. Every university that has an encampment is contributing significantly not only to trying and stop the genocide, but also for liberation in the longer run. So well done for anyone who is involved in it. And I'm very proud to say that also our students in Exeter are steadfast in their encampment. And it seems to be now spreading like fire all over not only the global north, but also the global south. I just got pictures from the encampment in Tokyo, in Seoul, places where usually you don't see large solidarity actions with the Palestinians. So hopefully this widespread global solidarity would make this even more effective as a tool to change the reality on the ground. A few weeks ago, I was stopped at Metro Airport in Detroit by two agents of the Homeland Security who took me aside to a room and ask me all kinds of questions, including about colonization and decolonization, which I don't think they fully understood what it meant, but they read from a paper. And I said to them, I need half an hour to explain to you, which was a mistake, because, of course, it was on my time, not their time. They had a shift. They could stay till midnight, and I was tired after the flight from London. But then I said, well, I should have invited them here, because here I'm going to give 30 minutes from colonization to decolonization. Maybe one of them is listening through the YouTube. If not, we'll send them the recording, because I didn't fulfill my promise to them, because I really wanted to get out of the airport as soon as possible. It is not easy, actually, for many people to talk about colonialism or decolonization in the 21st century. So many of us, colonialism is a period that more or less ended in the mid-20th century, with decolonization that also has already been completed. And one of the major reasons for that kind of difficulty to deal with colonialism in the 21st century is because so many of the colonialist projects that are still with us are a kind of a variety, which I'm sure you're all familiar by now with, a variety of colonialism, the settler colonialist variety, to which Zionism belong. This is not a period in history that can end when an imperial power collapses, or when colonialists are brought back home to the mother country, as happened in the case of the British and French and Belgian and Spanish and Portuguese empires. No, settler colonialism is a European phenomenon imposed on non-European countries that is still with us in different varieties. But it is a colonialist, first of all, a colonialist project. And by colonialism here, we mean that Europeans, for good reasons, for bad reasons, because they were persecuted, because they were looking for opportunities, it doesn't matter what the reason right now is, for whatever reason, felt that Europe is not safe or is not welcoming them. And they were outcasts in their own eyes or by the Europeans, and they were looking for a place to recreate Europe elsewhere. Unfortunately, they usually looked for a place where someone else already lived, inhabited it. And in order to recreate the Europe that they wanted, they needed to get rid of anyone who was not a European in the process. And we know that that kind of impulse, which the late Patrick Wolf used to call the logic of the elimination of the native, led to genocide in North America, Central America, South America, and in Palestine, it led to the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians until recently, and now to the genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza. So it is very important, I think, when we talk about colonialism or colonization in Palestine, to understand that there are layers of knowledge for people about colonialism that really regarded as a closed chapter in history. And it's not even a rejection of the idea that you can accuse Israel of colonialism or not. It might look to them anachronistic to use a term that does not fit the modern times. But I think if we insist on explaining what is so unique about settler colonialism, we may find a way to explain to people that this is an ongoing project. The same scholar I mentioned before, the late Australian scholar Patrick Wolf, also taught us something also the late Edward Said used to say, that settler colonialism is a structure, not an event. It's something that it goes on until the main objective of the settler colonial project is fulfilled, or until it is defeated. But if it's not fulfilled, and if it's not defeated, the logic that I mentioned before of the elimination of the native is the main logic behind the actions of the settler colonial project. Whether the settler colonial project is a project of building a state or a settler colonial project is maintaining a state. Now, if we apply that to Palestine, you can easily see that many of the Jews who chose Palestine as the place in which they thought they would feel safer than they felt in Europe because of the rise of anti-Semitism, or they thought that they could be more of a normal people if they defined Judaism not as a religion, but as nationalism, and for that they needed the connection to the Old Testament, the Torah, the Bible. Whatever the motive was, the objective was to create a European Western country exclusively Jewish from the very beginning. Now, unlike probably some of the settler colonial projects that were 200 or 300 years earlier, we are talking about a period where already the settlers know quite a lot about the country in which they want to build the new Jewish European country. So many of them were aware, unlike some of the white settlers who came to North America, for instance, in the 16th or 17th century, they were aware that there were other people living there. In fact, they sent a lot of delegations and agents and read a lot about it, and they knew that the land was not empty. And here comes the question, if they knew that the land is not empty, why one of their most known slogan was that there were people with the land, without a land, looking for a land without people. The reason is that they needed to think, sorry, that the land was empty in order to justify a moral action on their behalf. Because if you go to an empty land and take it over, there's no moral problem there. You go to a land already populated and inhabited, where your own people tell you that there are towns and villages, people who lived there for centuries, then you have a moral issue, and you want to have a self-image of not only saving yourself, not only building a nation state, but also doing it as a moral project. That was very important to them. And you, in order, absurdly, two things happened. One is they had to totally dehumanize the Palestinians in order to justify the colonization. Dehumanization can either mean using scholarly help to define the Palestinians as nomads, namely people who don't really belong to Palestine, they're sort of moving around, so it wouldn't be a big deal if they would be moved even for the project. Well, when we know that when Zionism arrived in Palestine in the late 19th century, only 1% of the Palestinians were nomads. So this was not working that well. Dehumanization could also mean beginning this kind of an Orientalist project by explaining why these people are less attached to the land, why, because they're not European, they're not on the same level of civilization. It takes form in many ways. But what is important is to understand the origin of this, and the origin of this is exactly because we are not talking about monsters. We're not talking about evil people. They needed to make sure that what was they were going to do would be seen in European eyes as a civilized act and not as an act of barbarism or a criminal act, because we have to remember that unlike the classical colonial projects, they didn't come to exploit the native people, which is what really characterizes classical colonialist project. You want to exploit the people of the colony, its resources, but also its human resources to enrich the empire. No, they didn't want to exploit the people. They wanted to remove the people. They needed exclusive Jewish presence, first of all, in order to show that the project is moral. Later on, In fact, when they were beginning, when I say they, I mean the leaders of the Zionist movement, the main activists of the Zionist movement, when they begin to think about what kind of a state they would like to have towards the mid-1940s, they said, we would like very much to have a democratic state. It was very important for them. But in order to have a democratic state that fits the settler colonial project of creating a Jewish nation state, you had to make sure that in the first election for the democratic state, the vast majority, if not all the people, would be Jewish. And that was the main motive for the decision when the back from probably the mid-1947, when it was clear that Britain would end its rule, its 30 years rule of Palestine, that's when the Zionist leadership began to think about massive expulsions of Palestinians. Ironically, so that the first election would have only a Jewish electorate. It took them a year to plan and a year to implement. And as already was mentioned, by the end of 1948, the Zionist movement was able to expel half of Palestine's population, destroy half of Palestine's villages, 500 out of 1,000, roughly, and most of the Palestinian towns. And on the ruins of the villages, they have built Jewish settlements, or they planted trees, European trees, of course, because they wanted the European countries. So they imported pine trees from Europe and planted them on the ruins of the Palestinian villages and created recreational parks instead of the villages. And in the towns themselves, they massively destroyed Arab houses so that the Arab character of the towns will not remain and remind them of what was there before 1948. At one moment in 1949, they stopped the destruction of Arab houses in Jaffa and Haifa and Acre because they suddenly realized that it has a touristic advantage to have some of these houses for people who come as tourists. But in my own hometown, Haifa, the Israeli army demolished more than 230 houses under the order of David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, who visited Haifa and didn't like the Arab nature of the city. That, by the way, nothing unique here. Settler colonialism acts in this way. It wants to retransform the nature of the native state into its own identity. It can appropriate certain things from the native: food, folklore, clothing, words, as we've seen elsewhere, right? But not the people themselves and not the way they lived. The Israelis did not go as far as the Americans in calling the lethal weapons in the names of Native American tribes that they have genocided: Apache helicopter or Tomahawk missiles. The Israelis did not go that far, but that is a symbolic act, of course, which is not that important. So in 1948, half of the people are expelled. Many of those who are expelled are still living on the borders of the old country, including in the Gaza Strip that was created in 1948 by Israel. There was no Gaza Strip before 1948. Gaza was a small town, very cosmopolitical, where Jews, Muslims, and Christians lived together. And because it was on the Via Maris, the road between Alexandria and Alexandretta, it was very much influenced by a lot of cultures and so on. Israel created the rectangle that you can see today, which is Gaza, because it had to push into it hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that it had expelled during the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Most of the people they expelled in the center of Palestine and the north of Palestine, they were able to force them to move outside of Israel, to the West Bank, in the east, or east into Syria, or in the north into Lebanon. But Egypt, as today, Egypt then, different Egypt, but with the same policy, closed its borders. It was not willing to take even one Palestinian refugee into the Sinai. You know, there is a border between Israel and Sinai. So Israel decided, in inverted commas, to give up 2% of Palestine, which is the Gaza Strip, and created it as the biggest refugee camp in the world in 1948, pushing hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees into it. But it was incomplete. Now, the ethnic cleansing was incomplete for two reasons. One, because the Israeli army was unable to expel all the Palestinians, and therefore the structure of settler colonialism continued. And secondly, because like all settler colonial movements in the world, you always want more territory, but you don't want the people on the territory. You always have these two dimensions, space and population, geography and demography. And in 1967, under circumstances which I don't have the time to go into, but Israel expanded the territory, occupying the West Bank and the Gaza Strip that it did not occupy in 1948. But if you occupy the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, you incorporate almost the same number of Palestinians at the time as you expelled. So the settler colonial practice of elimination of the native has not only to continue, it has to adapt itself all the time to changing circumstances. 1967 is not 1948. 1967, you have already television, you already have refugees that you want to expel again, and you have a very short war, 6 days war. And the Israelis, although they were thinking, contemplating whether they should repeat in 1967 in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip what they did in 48, decided against it because the world was much more attentive than in 1948 to what was going on. So if you don't expel the Palestinians, you build all kinds of methods and structures, which we can see today in the West Bank in particular, to control millions of people who don't want to be controlled by you, who see themselves as the indigenous native people, and see the Israelis as occupier, colonizers, ethnic cleansers, and so on. And they fight against it, sometimes with an armed struggle, sometimes by just staying, as they call it in Arabic, sumud, sometimes by asking for an international pressure on Israel, to make Israel a pariah state. It doesn't matter. What matters is that the anti-colonialist impulse is as strong as the colonialist one. Why hasn't the anti-colonialist impulse succeed, you may ask, after so many years? Well, that has to do with the imbalance of power. The imbalance of power. You cannot compare the power of the Palestinians to the power of the Israelis, because from the very beginning, Zionism had an alliance of Christians and imperial powers and colonial powers and multinational cooperation, a very powerful alliance that, whatever reason, genuine, cynical, doesn't matter, supported Israel against the Palestinians. And the Palestinians had allies, not very reliable ones, the Arab regimes. If you go into a struggle, don't rely on the Arab regimes. The Muslim world, I'm talking about the governments, not the people, were also not particularly impressive in their support. One should say the only force in history that showed some support for the Palestinians was the Soviet Union. I'm not going to idealize the Soviet Union here, but the only people who really provided weapons, training, and some support for the Palestinians was the Soviet Union, but there's no Soviet Union. And maybe it's also not the best ally in the world, so, it's gone, doesn't matter. But you cannot eliminate, really, in 21st century people, as maybe you could have in the 17th century or 18th century. So, coming to the end, I want to say something about Gaza in this connection, because we see both sides of the coin here. We see the colonization in its most brutal, there's no doubt about it. I lived through all this period, I'm 70 years old. I don't remember such level of brutality on the side of the Israelis. Nothing they did compares to what they're doing now. In every way, not just the actions themselves, but also the language that accompanies what they are doing. So on the one hand, the settler colonial project is still a structure that still continues. The indigenous people are still there. On the other hand, there is still the struggle of the indigenous people. And my feeling as an historian is that actually the decolonization of Palestine has begun at the very moment that the settler colonial project is using its worst brutal methods against it. And historically, this happened in South Africa, it happened in Algeria. There is a horrible dialectical connection between the cruelty of the settler colonial project and its shelf life. The brutality indicates that it's very close to its final days. And not necessarily only because of the Palestinian resistance and resilience. There are many other reasons why it's not working. One of them, of course, and the most important one, is that you cannot impose yourself on millions of people for more than 100 years and believe that this is somehow is going to work. That's for sure. But it's also not working because the basic idea of this settler colonial project, that Judaism is a religion, and that people can become one nation just because they used to be belonging to one religion, is not working. The secular and religious Jews in Israel have already been fighting each other before the 7th of October. They're even fighting each other now. This is implosion from within that is not going to work. You also cannot sustain something if you rely so much of one power, superpower. As strong as this superpower is, it will go through an isolationist phase, even under a Republican administration. And it's not the only power in the world anymore. And the civil societies are countering the powers of empires. Now, I'm talking here of long-term process. I'm not talking about the next, because I'm very worried that the colonization project in the next 2 years is going to be cruel, brutal, and will not only focus on the Gaza Strip, unfortunately, but will also already is moving towards the West Bank, but it will intensify the actions against the West Bank. It's very clear. But in the, I can see the light, if you want, in the end of that tunnel. And the light for me is decolonization, but what, two sentences, and with this I would end. A collapse, in a way, I see the Zionist project or the State of Israel as a building that was already built with cracks in the foundation. What the 7th of October did, it was like an earthquake. It really gave a strong blow to the structure, to the foundation of the building. And therefore, the cracks have really widened. And that's why it's far shaky than it was. The only problem is that one should, not the only, one of the problems people should pay attention to, that a collapse of a project does not necessarily bring something better. Look at the collapse of Syria, of Iraq, of Libya, and Yemen. A disintegration of a nation state does not necessarily bring a better political structure, unless there's someone there to fill the void, to take over, to be ready, not when it happens, but before. And that's, of course, the huge agency we're asking from the Palestinian National Movement to get their act together, to have a democratic and united and consensual leadership. Otherwise, they would miss the historical moment of the collapse. And that can happen. That can happen. And collapse can continue and be a chaotic reality. But I'm sure, I have a lot of confidence in the young Palestinian generation that they will build the right structure to move that leadership to the future. And this is possible. And this is not just possible for Palestine. This is necessary for what we call in Arabic the Mashrek, the Eastern Mediterranean. The whole area of Lebanon is collapsing. Syria is already disintegrated. The Hashemites, I don't know if anybody's relative of the king here, but do tell him that this is not going to hold on for very long. And we need a political structure that would replace the Westphalian nation state that the colonialist power imposed on the Eastern Mediterranean, the Mashrek, in the end of the First World War. We will need a political structure that reflects much better the collective identities of people, their legacies, And you don't always have to buy in the Western supermarkets ideas for the future. The area itself has a great reservoir of great ideas from the past, how to build a live and let live, a coexistence that would include a Jewish group of people, but not as Zionists, and not as ruling a state, and not as a settler colonial project. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ilan. I'm going to go ahead and open it up right away, because I'm sure there will be many questions. Maybe we could take three, or do we want... Okay, go ahead. Yeah, there, then there. Yaza.
Just tap the button.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much for a really interesting talk. I'm just kind of trying to think about the different terms that have been used to describe what is going on now and what has happened before. You referred to ethnic cleansing in 1948, genocide now. Mavish, she referred to Nakbas in the plural, something that you usually don't do in Arabic. Nakba is a kind of a concept. It's not a criticism, but really kind of trying to think about the concepts with which we analyze what is going on, the historical emergence and specificity. The Holocaust as the kind of paradigmatic event that gave rise to the idea of genocide that was applied retroactively to previous events. Say, you know, we talk about the Armenian genocide, which was not described as a genocide back then. Is there, and you also mentioned settler colonialism, which is a concept that comes from the scholarship on Northern America, Australia, right? Is there a way to kind of theorize a kind of a decolonial or anti-colonial project from the Palestine itself? You know, can we theorize the Nakba, for example, as a concept that allows for imagining not just what happened but what could happen in the future?
We had a question there, right? Yeah, that's you. Yeah, go ahead.
Can you hear me now? Okay, so we are neighbors. You're from Haifa, I'm from Tamra. So I wanted to ask you whether you can speak about, you spoke about, you know, Gazans and people in West Bank, how the brutality is going to escalate for them. I wanted to, if you can also reflect on escalations on Palestinians within the Israeli borders and colonization of them or decolonizations of them, and what do you think? I'm sure you know how there's a complete silencing now and a complete surveillance over what they say and what they do in this genocide or war or whatever you want to call it now. And what do you think, how can they take part in decolonization as well? Thank you.
Can we take one more? Yeah.
We've got two online.
Oh, we got two online. Why don't I actually insert one question, which is associated with Yazan from myself. This is what you get to do as chair. prerogative. Very short, which is a recent article that was rejected, from Harvard Law Review and published in Columbia Law Review about theorizing the Nakba potentially as an international legal category, as something that fragments, physically fragments. If you could just also comment on that, and I'll let you take these three.
Yeah. First of all, the question of theorization of from within Palestine, or using theorization from other paradigms, whether it's the paradigms of genocide, the paradigms of settler colonialism. I think this is a dynamic issue, and it maybe it also refers to your question. I'll give you an example. I'm now researching some chapters in the history of Israel in the 50s and the 1960s. And it's very clear to me that the Palestinian citizens in Israel, these are the Palestinians who stayed in Israel after 1948, they call themselves sometimes the 48 Arabs, were talking about the Israeli regime as al-ihtilal, the occupation. They didn't talk about a military rule, or they said we're second-rate citizens, or we live in an apartheid state. They said we're under occupation. And I think many of them would still think that they are under occupation. In fact, and therefore, we keep searching, I think, for these this kind of balance that you're talking about from frameworks and definitions that emanate organically from the place itself, from the region maybe, from its history and civilization, and those that help us by comparative study, by looking at other periods, at other places, to in order, what is the main objective of these exercises? Is to try to clarify accurately as we can what was going on. For instance, for me, the word, as I understood the concept Nakba, as a catastrophe, this was like, you know, something that, a natural disaster. Nobody is responsible for a natural disaster. And that's why I thought this is not a good enough term for me. I respected the term because I knew so many Palestinians and others are using the term and they know what it means. But I thought for most people in the world, catastrophe would not be enough. I said that there was a crime against humanity committed and there are criminals and there are victims. And so I went to the international legal vocabulary and I found ethnic cleansing. And that's why I used it. I think I was the first one ever to use ethnic cleansing about 1948, because I said, I know exactly who did it. I know the names of the criminals. By the time I wrote, most of them were dead, but doesn't matter. I mean, I didn't went to seek them in hell to sue them, but at least I wanted it for the historical record, that the names would be there. If I would have written about the catastrophe, you know, people would say, okay, you know, as Benny Morris would say, things happen in a war. No, things don't happen in a war. The war was happening because of the crime. Not the crimes were committed because there was a war. The war was a crime planned by the ethnic cleanser in order to have the context, in order to get rid of the Palestinians. So I think we're still there, still looking. I remember my supervisor in Oxford was the late and great Albert Hourani. And he all the time, and this is a far more mundane issue, but he to the last day of his life, he wasn't sure how to define in English the class of notables in the Arab world, the Ayan. He said, he always said to me, you know, I use the word notables, but it's not good. So I said, okay, so why are you not, Professor Hourani, why are you not using something else? I don't have anything else. But I have to make sure that they understand in the West that this is not the feudals. They're not the feudals of the West. It's a different kind of relationship between the rural notable and the villagers, the urban notable. And he said, this is a bad translation, but nobody, he said, came with a better one. And we're still looking, you know, there's all these kinds of things. Europe produced the knowledge for all of us, including knowledge of ourselves outside of Europe. And we still speak in English in order to tell them that... as he did in English, to tell them that they are criminals. You know, all the dialogue groups in Israel are in Hebrew, not in Arabic. All the dialogue groups in the West are in English and not in Arabic. This is the world we live in, but it's a good project. Now, to the 48 Arabs, the minority in Israel, I think that, first of all, they are also under great danger. They're already suffering after the 7th of October, one of the worst periods in their own life. People are being suspended, fired, imprisoned for just tweeting support with the people in Gaza. They've never, since the 50s, they have never gone through such a period, and I'm afraid even for them it will be worse. But I think what is really problematic, but a huge challenge for the almost 2 million Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship, is that their political leadership believed for so many years that they can play in both political fields, the Israeli political field and the Palestinian political field. I think the time has come for them to take a strategic decision. They need to take a strategic decision. Playing in the Israeli political field brought them no benefits whatsoever. They need to play only in the Palestinian political field, but they're afraid of doing it. I understand it. I'm not part of them. I don't want to condemn something that I cannot do myself, because I'm not there. I'm not them. But I do think that this would be very important, by the way, not only in order to strengthen the internal Palestinian debate. They are really the only Palestinians in the world that know the Israelis not only as settlers and soldiers. And that leaves some hope for reconciliation and more restorative justice in the future, not just retribution, because decolonization will happen. Palestine would be liberated. The question is how. And we don't want it to be violent, not just for the sake of those who might be affected by it, but it's also not good, as Franz Fanon told us, for the colonized themselves to be a colonizer again. So this is a very important group, usually forgotten, marginalized, in the totally misunderstood in the Arab world, but definitely one to pay attention to, definitely.
Thank you. Let's take a question, or the two questions from online,
yeah,
and then one back there.
Three.
Oh, now there's three.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks. Okay, so there's three questions online. I'll just go through quickly. Hopefully I pronounce your names correctly. So there's Michael Cole from Imperial College London. Asks, for those of us working in faculty development to help increase awareness and understanding of decolonizing education and solidarity and embodying and enacting it, what would you focus on in the first session staff attend on the matter, operating within the current confines of the post-colonial capitalist university in London? That's question one. Question two. Parth Sharma, a decolonial writer from India, asks, my question is that Gaza today has become a necropolitical paradigm. In the process of decolonization, then, is there space for coexistence between Palestinians and a majority Zionist state of Israel? And there's one more question, then we'll take it back to you. So this is from Surbi Kassar, lecturer in economics department at SOAS University of London. Surbi asks, can you identify what is the particularity of this settler colonial project of Palestine that is different than other settler colonial projects? And what are the specificities of this project that are shaped by the current context of neoliberal capitalism?
Great. For the first question, it's very difficult to know how to start, but I would suggest in many ways to try and go back to the basics of how production of knowledge emerged on the Arab world, the Muslim world, or what Edward Said called the Orient. Maybe go back to his work, Orientalism, to start with. And in order to understand that an academic discourse, an academic language by the West, what Stuart Hall used to call the West and the rest, the academic language on the Middle East has its roots in colonialism and imperialism. And it was powerful not because it had a certain vocabulary or certain images, but because there were huge institutions, powerful institutions behind it. It can be a very poor vocabulary, not very rich, maybe not even logical, maybe superficial, but what matters is not the quality of the discourse. Far more important are who is sustaining it. Zionism was a similar thing, because if you take the Zionist early propaganda and you watch and you kind of read their first interchange with people around the world to convince them to support Zionism, you understand that it could not have been the story that they've told themselves. I mean, this story that they used to live in Palestine 2,000 years before, and therefore they are entitled to Palestine even if someone else lives there. This ridiculous claim became powerful because very powerful institutions supported it. The Palestinian counterclaim was very logical. They said, we lived there for 1,000 years at least. We are the majority. We are undergoing processes of modernization and nationalization. We know what we want. And you are anyway promising to give it to anyone else after you dismantle the Ottoman Empire. But nobody was listening to them. Not in London, not in Washington, not in Paris. Not because the claim was not logic or didn't even fit the Western ideas of enlightenment and modernization. No, because they had no powerful institutions behind them. So I think that's a good place to start with. The second question, I got carried away, so I forgot. Just give me a cue.
Next. Second question was the particularity of this settler colonial project in Palestine that's different from others.
I thought it was the third, no?
That was the third, but you start with the third.
You're right. I'll start with the third.
I'll start with that and then remind me, yeah. Seeing them. Still not total dementia. If I know it was the third, that's very encouraging. You may not know where the keys are, but you still remember what they're for. Okay. Right. Yeah, there are particularities. And of course, every settler colonial project has particularities. And some of them are complicating not so much the story itself, but definitely the way of solving it. So one particularity is the historical timing. Most settler colonial projects started at a time where it was not that difficult to think about non-Europeans as savages, as non-existing subhumans, if you want. Zionism appears at a time where not only colonialism reaches a peak, but also anti-colonialism begins to be contemplated and seriously discussed by people in the colonialist world. Not to mention the fact that the State of Israel is established at the same year that the Human Rights Declaration is being declared and or initiated. That the international legal tribunals are being initiated. So the historical timing brings a set of moral values, whether people genuinely believe in them or not, which makes it very difficult to justify the whole Zionist project. Whereas nobody looked for justification to build the United States, Canada, Australia, or New Zealand, for that matter. Another feature is, and the one that Israeli historians like to note, is the fact that there was a timeless connection between the Jewish people and the land of Palestine through the Bible. And nothing like that existed in other settler colonial projects. So first of all, this is not entirely true. If you look at the names of the first colonies that the white Europeans built in the United States, you can see that the name Zion appears a lot because they did believe that this was the promised land. As much as the Jews believed that Palestine was the promised land, the evangelical Christians and alongside them, the Puritans who came even earlier, believed that they were coming to a holy land. So Zionism is not the only movement that used a holy book and turned it into a political manifesto in order to justify colonization. It was done elsewhere. But what is really important, of course, that the whole connection of Judaism to Palestine is not different from the Christian connection to Palestine, the Muslim connection to Palestine, so you cannot really build on this. Maybe there's a kind of, there's an interesting story that is, 93% true. I'm adding 7% so as they do in fiction that is based on doc, but only with the characters. But it's a very indicative. It's very indicative. It is actually a true story. In 1936, 1937, Britain sent an inquiry commission to Palestine, one of many that was sent by Britain during the mandatory period, because they were looking for a solution. And this was the most important one, probably because it happened after a year into the revolt of the Palestinians, a really serious revolt of the Palestinians against Britain and its pro-Zionist policy. It was called the Peel Commission. And the Peel Commission was about to come to Palestine, and hopefully the Britain, or from the British point of view, would offer a solution. And the most important historian of the Jewish community tells in his memoirs, that's why I'm saying I'm not sure how much of all of it was there, but it's interesting. He tells that the story that the leader of the Jewish community, David Ben-Gurion, tells him that in 2 or 3 weeks' time, a British inquiry commission would come to Palestine to find out what is the best solution for the conflict, as they called it, between the Zionist settlers and the Palestinians. And Ben-Gurion said, I think it would be very helpful if you, as a leading historian, would take a group of historians and would show that there was continuity of Jewish presence from the Roman time until today. The historian was very happy. He said, now I can get maybe some resources. He told Ben-Gurion, yes, I can gather a group of historians and we will do this huge project. We will show the continuity of Jewish presence. And Ben-Gurion asked him, how long do you need to prove that? And he said, well, it's a project of years, maybe 10 years. You know, it's a huge thing, different periods, different languages. Ben-Gurion said, you don't understand. The Peel Commission is coming in 2 weeks' time. So you will prove that there was Jewish continuity. You will have afterwards 10 years to prove it if you want, but you will state that there was. And I think this is the kind of relationship you had between what people would call the unique feature of the Jewish settler colonialism. The last one I would add, and then we'll go to the third question. Undoubtedly, the fact that Europe decided that the best way to deal with the genocide of the Jews in the Second World War was to build for the Jews a state at the expense of the Palestinians is something you cannot find anywhere else. That is true. That is absolutely true. The fact that the West, and not just the Europe, the West as a whole, decided that the best way to deal with racism and genocide inside Europe, of the worst kind that happened for many centuries, is by accepting the Zionist idea that was already there, that it would be better for the Jews to be in Palestine, which is an anti-Semitic idea if you think about it. Europe should have done its utmost to tell the Jews, we don't want any one of you after the Holocaust who leaves for Palestine is a total moral defeat of our values as Europeans. But of course, they didn't offer half of Germany to the Jews. They offered most of Palestine to the Jews. This is something that needs to, this is a genealogy we need to revisit. It's very, very important. I just edited a book with a German friend, and we still suggested that Germany can offer a Jewish state. I can see already the German police stopping the printer before it gets to the shops. But we have other means of trying to say to the Germans, especially because the Germans are very pro-Israelis, if you're so pro-Israelis, Baden-Württemberg is fine for me. It doesn't matter, whichever country, as long as we can lift the oppression, colonization of the Palestinians, whatever non-violent means as possible. Yeah, I missed the question.
So last one is, Gaza today has become a necropolitical paradigm. In the process of decolonization, then, is there space for coexistence between Palestinians and a majority Zionist state of Israel?
Yeah. It's very difficult to envisage life together right now between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I assume when you live in Gaza, it's even more difficult to envisage any cohabitation with the people who are genociding you. That's why I said the 48 Arabs have a different experience as Palestinians with Israelis. It's not all bloodshed and violence. There's also cultural, economic, business relationships. It builds some sort of a future vision. Historically speaking, I think that this is not the right question, whether they can or cannot. No, the question is, how do we challenge what I would call the peace orthodoxy? How do we challenge the basic assumption on which the Western world has led us for 56 years into what it called the peace process in Israel and Palestine? The main assumption of the peace orthodoxy, which was born in the United States, Israel, Norway, places like this, that first of all, Israelis should always be the one who conceived the idea for a solution, and the Palestinians should react. So we should counter that assumption to begin with. The Palestinians should lead, offer a vision, and let the Israelis react for once. Because for 76 years, it was always Israeli or pro-Israeli ideas, and the Palestinians reacted. So that's one. And secondly, it's time for the Palestinians to tell us how do they see the Jews in a liberated Palestine. Until now, the conversation is how Israelis are willing to envisage a Palestinian state or not a Palestinian state, a Bantustan. The conversation is not how the Palestinians envisage the Israelis, but how the Israelis envisage the Palestinians. That's the wrong conversation. Now, why do I think this is an answer to the question? Because finally, there will be a clear message from the Palestinians to purchase to something we can call the third generation of settlers. And there will be kind of an idea of what kind of collective identity of Jews in a liberated Palestine does not constitute a threat, a settler colonial threat to the indigenous people. Very much as like Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela were seeking in the relationship between the whites and the Africans. And as you know, what they suggested was to call the whites in South Africa another tribe in order to include it in the revised history of South Africa. Yeah. Now, if I would give this lecture in Israel, the Israelis would say to me, you know, this is suicidal for us. This is the end of Israel. First of all, it is the end of Israel. I mean, yes, absolutely. Israel is going to end. The question is how? How? How is it going to end? What will replace it? What will replace it? And I suppose that if we are talking about, and right now we can talk only about principles, nobody has a clear program. But we know which programs don't work, like the two-state solution that has already been dead for many years, but the body was in the morgue. We were never invited to the funeral. But the two-state solution is dead for many years now. So we can talk about principles now of equality. First of all, the most important thing that is absent from all the peace proposals is equality. So equality is of all kinds, social justice, economic justice, but also, of course, equality between everybody who lives between the river and the sea. And you can build these principles and you can imagine, and that I take it into granted, I take it for granted, that quite a lot of Israeli Jews would say, under such circumstances, by losing all the privileges that we have, by not being, finally realizing that they are in the Arab world and not in Europe, maybe some of them would say, or many of them, I don't know, would say, this is not for me, especially if they have options to reignite life elsewhere. Fine. Quite a lot of white people left South Africa in the post-apartheid era. So the question is not how would two people live together given the killing field that we are watching here. The question is who would lead the way for a different future and who would be willing to live in that different future, which is not a Zionist state, a different kind of a state. And not everything is soluble immediately. I mean, it's not just Jews and Arabs who have to decide how to live together, religious people and secular people have to decide what kind of live and let live they have, different communities. I mean, there's There are a lot of challenges ahead. None of that is going to be easy. But we want to start talking about these things because for 56 years, we didn't talk about the real issues. We talked about the irrelevant issues.
Thank you. We had a question back there.
Hello. So my question is about, I was reading actually some of your works a while back, and there's something which not many people know, but like...
I was thinking just go ahead and introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. I'm Momin. I'm a master's student at LSE. So my question is about, you know, how in the 1940s, you can correct me if I'm wrong, there was Zionism was not actually what it is today. A lot of like, it consisted of a lot of like minority Jews, and they were actually anti-state, anti-Israel. So I just wanted to know that what was that like and how that translated into what Zionism looks like today, which is like secular colonialism.
Thank you. We can take two more questions. Yeah, over here and then back there.
Thank you very much.
well, please do introduce yourself.
Sunil Kumar, Social Policy at LSE. No other book angered me more than The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. And something very vivid there stuck in my mind about the surveillance and the village files you talk about in 1948. My question was much more about the light at the end of the tunnel. And you spoke about the cracks in the Zionist and the settler colonial project. And you also said that the next couple of years are going to be quite brutal. And I wanted to ask you, in the next couple of years, are we going to have the same silence, not just from the governments in the north, but also from the south? I mean, looking at India, for example, and how India has been kind of actually weaponized this whole process in terms of its own kind of angst with Muslims, and so on and so forth.
Thank you.
Thank you. Back there.
Hi, I'm Inam. I'm a PhD student at the Geography and Environment. My question is about the history of future. So you were talking about the earthquake. We are quite far from the epicenter, but we are still shaken all over the world. And it seems this settler colonial project is not just in Palestine, it's all over the world, because when we try to divest, boycott, or sanction, we feel it in every bit of our life, everywhere. So it has expanded like unlike anything else, and the holy, unholy alliance that's behind it is pretty much controlling all of us. So this allyship that has gone throughout the world with encampments and many other ways, how do you see the future of this?
Thank you. First of all, the question about anti-Zionists before 1948. First, I think it's true to and it's important to revisit the history of Zionism until 1948 and to realize that it started as a minority view among Jews around the world. Most of the Jews in the world did not subscribe to Zionism. Either they were very religious Jews who believed that Zionism is tempering with God's will, and therefore they didn't support the colonization of Palestine, or they were influenced by socialist and Marxist ideas and believed that an international revolution would solve anti-Semitism and on any other kind of racism, or they were liberals who believed similarly that a more liberal democratic world would solve racism, including racism against Jews. In Palestine itself, it was always a minority position. It was either Orthodox Jews who remained loyal to this idea that colonization of Palestine is against God's will, and they saw themselves as guests of the Palestinians, but not as colonizers of Palestine, but it's a minority view inside. It was, even in the 40s, it was a minority views. Non-religious Jews who were anti-Zionist within the Zionist project were very small in number. I think the voices are very important because they led the foundation for the kind of conversations that we have today. I think, now talking about the cracks in the building, one of the important cracks in the building is the way that the younger Jewish generation around the world does not associate Judaism anymore with Zionism. Not only that, they even see their role as supporting the solidarity movement with the Palestinians as an indication or as a manifestation of their new relationship with Zionism, many of them coming from families for where Judaism was easily equated with Zionism. So that's a very important development that I think would have huge influence on the realities in Israel, in Palestine, not by itself, but these are discrete kind of indications that eventually fuse together into a powerful, I think, transformative moment that will happen. And that relates to both the questions on this side, which I think have something similar in it. I think we are, first of all, both of you are right. There is a global dimension here to the question of Palestine. And therefore, I recently have been talking about two kind of alliances that clash in the world. One is global Israel and one is global Palestine. Global Israel is the kind of alliance that supports not only Israel. It supports settler colonialism in Kashmir. It supports Erdogan's fascist policy in Hungary. And I can give a long list of projects that what I call global Israel supports. But the support for Israel is the most important one because supposedly in the case of Israel, they're supporting a democracy. And that's kind of the idea is that it projects to the other less savory projects because, after all, we are here supporting the only civilized democratic country in the Middle East. But global Israel is made of Christian Zionists, some Jewish communities, multinational corporation, military industry, securitization industry, fascist right-wing parties that have done so well in the European Parliament election the other day, Hinduvita people in India that brought Modi once more to power, and the kind of right-wing politics that sometimes emerge in Latin America and even in Central Africa. So there is global Israel. But what is important is global Palestine, because global Palestine all the time increases. Global Palestine is civil society, together probably with some countries in the global south, that inject back certain moral values into politics. They're unwilling to accept that politics is just a combination of cynical interests that really where morality is used only to gloss over the real interests and so on. And what is so unique about Palestine, I think, first of all, Palestine has not yet been decolonized. And because it hasn't been decolonized, there's still hope that its decolonization would lead to a post-colonial entity that would reflect a different kind of politics. And it doesn't matter whether you want a different kind of politics because you are worried about the ecological policies of the government, the policies towards poverty, towards social justice, and so on. There is one place there where you think maybe there the void can be filled with something that we are genuinely thinking about as a better world. And global Palestine has transformed enormously in the last few years. It took time for African Americans to support the Palestinians because in their churches, they were told that the Jews are the slaves of Africa. Still some of their preachers say this, that they have to support the Jews because the Jews are like the slave, the African slave who came to the United States. But this has changed in the younger generation, African American, Native Americans, the First Nation in Canada, in Australia, in New Zealand, trade unions in Latin America, people around the world struggling for their own justice, see Palestine as a litmus paper, as a kind of manifestation of all these struggles put together. And that's a powerful energy. Why am I optimistic about it? Because you can say, okay, it's not powerful enough to challenge what I call global Israel, because I have a different interpretation than most people have for what happened in the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, and the ICC, the International Criminal Court. But this also is based by talking to judges there. What the ICJ and the ICC did, they decided for the first time not to heed just to pressure from governments. For the first time, they said, let's have a ruling, which shows you, by the way, that justice domestically or internationally is politics. There isn't objective justice. I hope you are woken up to this idea long time when you were born. But it depends which politics influences the justice. There's no objective justice. No, none of the judicial decisions of domestic or international courts are objective or professional only. So they decided that their politics would reflect for the first time what they believe the civil societies all around the world would have loved an international tribunal to decide on a question like Palestine. And that was the main reason that they allowed a certain language that was not allowed before. If someone would have told you 10 years ago that the ICJ would talk about genocide or the ICC would look at the Israelis as leaders as criminals, nobody would have believed you that this was possible. Now, this is not changing the reality on the ground because they don't have the power of sanctions. But we should not look at the power of sanctions. I'm not an international jurist, so I'm talking here as an historian. What we should look at is their idea to reflect a moral set of value that is not that of the political elites when it comes to Palestine. And that's highly, highly important. It's not good enough news for the people of Gaza. It's not good enough for the people of the West Bank and not good enough for the Palestinians inside Israel or the people in South Lebanon. But it is the beginning of that journey that leads me to believe that there is a light there in the end of the tunnel, because it's an upgrade from the civil society on the way to the centers of power where decisions are being made, and hopefully one day would be made. I also see in this light the recognition of Palestine by Norway, Spain, and Belgium. I don't 10 years ago, I was against it. I said, why do the Palestinians need the world to recognize the Bantustan, which is the greater Ramallah, that will be called the state of Palestine? It's humiliating. It's offensive, the state of Palestine 10 years ago. But I think this time, the recognition is not about the borders of Palestine. It's recognition of the idea of Palestine. Because there's a fear that the genocide is trying to erase Palestine as an idea. And that's another very positive development. And therefore, this will take time, and I think that this kind of set of values and the redefinition was international or not will also affect India, will also affect other places where we feel that right now there is a tide of history against forces of justice and progressive forces. But maybe historians have more patience because we see macro-historical processes. And the macro-historical process is not always the one that is micro, the one that is immediately seen. And I think there is, of course, it's one scenario out of many, but we are not just observers of these processes. We can contribute to their success, and that's very important to remember.
One final round. I'm going to right here. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Sadia from Sociology Masters. I was just wondering, you've told us a very specific story here that encourages hope, I think, but also of the history of Israel. And recently we actually had a different story from a visitor at the LSE, Benny Morris. And I was just wondering what you might have to say about the platform given to voices like Benny Morris's in moments like we are in right now.
Yeah, go ahead.
My question is actually very linked to what our colleague said. Basically, it's been very validating to hear the history of the establishment of the State of Israel, because it seems as though even the bare saying and explaining what happened concretely seems to be up to debate when we still have survivors of the Nakba that are alive today. So my own grandparents are older than the state of Israel. So these stories and the way that it happens is still vivid and it's still very much a discourse. However, even on that discourse, it seems that there is a general amnesia where every single thing that happened since 1948 or even before 1948 comes out of the imagination of Palestinians, the imagination of a potential Palestine, when the very Balfour Declaration was actually saying that it was in Palestine. So even the idea of Palestine is contested. And my question is, obviously with the genocide in Gaza, not only is it a genocide, there's an educide, there's an ecocide, there's a whole erasure of history, of heritage, of cultural heritage, of knowledge, with archive centers being burned to the ground, with libraries and hundreds of thousands of books burned to the ground, with information workers have been killed, scholars killed, academics killed. So how do we engage in a way that this history is not forgotten and we avoid the both-sidist narrative that would diminish and normalize the fundamentally asymmetrical relationship of power, just like it happened at LSE, where until today, as you said, that the idea of a two-state solution is dead long time ago, but it seems as though it's very much on the table in this very institution that is a leading institution in political science.
Thank you. Back there. That'll unfortunately have to be our final question.
I was just wondering, there seems to be like increasing talk of war with Hezbollah coming in the US and Israeli media and political establishment, and was wondering whether you think, what do you think about the prospects of that actually happening? And if it does happen, what does that mean for the sort of timescale and dynamics for the decline of the Zionist project that you've spoken about?
Thank you. I think that absolutely denialism or denial of the Nakba is still going on. It's still going on. And ironically, Benny Morris, who in his first book, The Birth of the Refugee Problem, the evidence he gathered should have helped us to deny, to struggle against the denial of the Nakba, is one of the biggest Nakba deniers today, not because he says that anyone talking about the expulsion of the Palestinians is lying, because he said it was morally right to do so. I wonder if a university like LSE would invite someone who would deny the Holocaust. I think they wouldn't allow David Irving to give a lecture. But you can deny the Nakba, unfortunately. So we need to struggle against it. Although I founded the first ever Center for Palestine Studies in a Western university, the University of Exeter, I still feel that you cannot do it properly in the university. And for that reason, I created with friends a movement called the Nakba Memorial Foundation, which is a charity in Britain. You can see the website, Nakba Memorial Foundation, which focuses on the struggle against the Nakba denial. Our hope is to establish in London a building that will be a center against Nakba denial. There are many centers against Holocaust denial in the world. There's not one center against Nakba denial. We're going to establish it in London. London, for various reasons and obvious reasons, why Britain has to be reminded of the end of the Nakba denial. We are also salvaging documents that Israel has closed in 2016, and we digitized them and put them on the website. You can already see them. Not all of them, of course, just kind of an example. So I would say we need to insist that a Nakba denial is like a Holocaust denial, and we should struggle not only in the university but outside the university against the Nakba denial. I had a very interesting correspondence with the chair of the charity committee in Britain when I suggested of opening, you need a license to be a charity. And the first reaction, they denied us the right to have such a charity, claiming two things. That the term Nakba is political. You know, you cannot have a charity which is political in Britain. So they said the term Nakba is political, and the term Palestine is questionable. So I wrote to him and I said, I'm giving you a week before I go to the Foreign Office, which recognizes that Palestine exists. We start a campaign that Britain does not recognize the Palestinians or the Nakba. Luckily, and that's something that's changed because of the 7th of October, they retracted their first reaction and they allowed us to have the website. They keep looking, I know, all the time to see if it's politics. Not that anything cannot be politics, right? I mean, going to the toilet in university is politics. I mean, this is ridiculous. But nonetheless, they have a certain definition of politics. But what is important is to continue this struggle and not to give up. And it's part of the struggle for liberation. Undoubtedly, it's a very important struggle for liberation. We are doing this. And as I say, I thought we can do it in where knowledge is produced. Universities have their own limitations of knowledge production, so sometimes you need an independent. That's my idea, that you need an independent institution. Hopefully, this would we will be able to do it. So look at the Nakba Memorial Foundation website, see what we're doing. We're calling for people to help us in the struggle against Nakba denial. I'm sure we're not the only ones. I'm not taking here an exclusive role, but this is one of hopefully many initiatives. Which brings me to the last question. It was the last question, right? Yeah. Hezbollah. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
First of all, there is already an attrition war between Hezbollah and Israel. Hundreds of thousands Lebanese in the south have left South Lebanon. Many villages are half demolished. Hundreds of thousands Israelis left the Galilee, half of their places are demolished. So to talk about will there be a war between Israel and Hezbollah, there is a war between Israel and Hezbollah. I think what you're talking about is would it escalate? Would Israel invade South Lebanon? I think it will. But I'm not sure. I have to be careful with these predictions because there's a way of stopping it, of course. And there is this ironic kind of clock between Gaza and Lebanon. If the Israelis would declare that Gaza, or the war on Gaza is successful, then they would move to the north. If they will feel that they need another year to fight the Hamas in Gaza, then they would not escalate the war. A lot depends on the international community watching this. Do they allow it to happen? It's very worrying. Let's put it this way, without being a prophet saying exactly how it would unfold. But I will finish because you said something which I think you meant and I agree. Whatever happens there is another crack in the structure. Is another crack. I don't know if it's as big as the other cracks I think there are in this structure or in the Zionist structure in Palestine. It's another crack that we will see the beginning of the end of this project. And I always warn people, the beginning of the end is a very dangerous period. It's not a very optimistic one. It's not a very nice one, exactly because it's the beginning of the end. I wish there were good news about that, but I think it's where you gather some courage and optimism because you understand it's the beginning of something that could end much better or much in a different way. So we should double and triple our efforts to stop the genocide. People in Gaza, in the West Bank, don't have time for my optimistic scenario to unfold. They're thinking about tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. We are doing a lot. I know we are all doing a lot. But we need to do more if we have not succeeded in stopping one killing in Gaza or in the West Bank. It's frustrating, but it means that we need to think more creatively jointly and so on, and believe that we have the power. We have the power to do this because one thing people in Gaza need is our, not just our solidarity, but our actual help, because the imbalance of power is still such that no one really comes to their aid, and they are totally defenseless in front of an army with all the cutting-edge weaponry that Britain and the United States keep supplying to them. Thank you very much for your solidarity.